Hello, this is Chris Lydon from Open Source. This week, we're tickled to recommend the Long Form podcast, a weekly conversation with writers and journalists. If you like our show, you'll love theirs. Check out Max Linsky's interview with Brooke Gladstone of WNYC's On the Media on longform.org/podcast. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. All roads lead to Rome, they say. Are we there yet? In 2016, most especially, our own imperial anxiety, the shuddering sound of our own democracy, must have something to do with the heat around Mary Beard's lean and learned new history of Rome on the library waiting list near you and flying out of bookstores. SPQR is her title, the letters you can still see on manhole covers in Rome, short for the Senate and People of Rome, and standing for the whole paradox of rulers and citizens, Republic and Empire. Short form, if it's in our story this year, it was foreshadowed in Rome. Rights of immigrants, violence as spectacle, military overreach, the privileges of citizenship, and the buying of power, bread and circuses, an old Roman coinage to begin with, and Cicero's eternal question in politics, cui bono, for whose benefit? Mary Beard is our lead-off guest this hour, coming into her own imperial phase on the BBC and groaning bookshelves everywhere as the English historian of the classical world. Chris Hedges, the American scourge with a Roman touch, and his classics teacher at Harvard, Kathleen Coleman, are with us to chase down the implications of the Roman riddles like, where really is virtue to be found? What is the end of this story? And from the beginning, what was the secret that made a world empire out of a sleepy village on the Tiber? Here is the Mary Beard version in conversation this week from her home in England, the other Cambridge.
For me, I think the main answer to that question is that Rome is an incorporating state which distributes and shares its citizenship with the outside world. It sees itself as a nation of immigrants. And as it expands, instead of drawing a very firm boundary between Romans and the people they govern, what Rome does is it lets people into the rights of its citizen polity. Now, I don't think they do that because they're nice woolly liberals in any kind of modern sense. I'm not even sure that they knew why they did it. But it starts to give them an overwhelming advantage militarily, because what citizens mean in the ancient world is fighters. And the more citizens Rome gets, the bigger an army they can put in the field.
Mm. It works for Rome, obviously, but it seeds, dare I say, a Roman dream, not so far from the American dream of immigration and of transformation.
I think the nearest parallel you can find, if you look at how Rome thinks it begins, and you see that Rome says, look, we started as a city of refugees. We started when Aeneas, the Trojan hero, flees from the burning city of Troy. You know, he's a war refugee, and he comes to Italy. That's one version. The other version is that it starts with the famous twins Romulus and Remus, who found a little city on the Tiber and suddenly realised that you can't found a city if you haven't got any citizens. Mm. And Romulus, when he's killed Remus, a rather blot on the early history of Rome, basically says, anybody can come here. Rome can be an asylum. Asylum seekers welcome. You can come whether you're a runaway slave or a criminal or anyone on the hoof. Come to Rome and be citizens. Now, in terms of the ancient world, and I think actually in terms of the modern world, that's a very, very unusual foundation story. And it is, I suppose, closest to the idea that you can, I'm speaking here from a British perspective, you can cross the Atlantic and you can go to America and you can make your fortune and you can belong. If for Rome, citizens aren't just born, as some of them are, you can become Roman. Romans are made.
In Rome, and in your television version, I mean, some of the most graceful touches about Rome come in these small monuments of rather ordinary Romans butchers and bakers from Spain and Syria and Africa and the Jewish Eastern Mediterranean, and they make their different marks as citizens in Rome. And obviously, it's a very big personal deal.
One of the ways you see what that kind of essential openness of Roman society really means is by looking at some of the quite simple gravestones and epitaphs that the people who were sucked into Rome left behind them. And there are some really very, very moving ones. One of my favourite comes from a very large, and I have to say slightly vulgar, tomb of an extremely successful baker who put up a vast pile of a monument in the shape of a bread oven. But around the sides, as well as displaying in a wonderful, proud detail the baking craft and what his workshops look like, he also blazons his name, of course, and his name is Marcus Virgilius Eurysiches. And that name gives away little hints about his background. He's almost certainly, with the name Eurysiches, a man from the East, and he's very, very likely an ex-slave. So what you've got there is a man who's come to Rome, probably enslaved in the wars of Roman conquest. He gets freed because many, many Roman slaves were freed and became Roman citizens, and he makes it big. Marcus Virgilius Eurysiches is a big guy. There are loads and loads of these people who, you know, have come from all kinds of bits of the Roman world. And they've been dealing, you know, in olives from Spain, or they've fetched up as tutors or doctors brought from the East. And they come to Rome, and what they do is they become Roman. And you don't have to pass a citizenship test. You know, you don't have to pay money. You don't have to salute the flag. You don't have to swear allegiance to the Queen. The important point is that you can become a Roman citizen as part of the life cycle of a man or a woman from overseas.
So what claim does a Roman citizen, this Cetus, have in the world? And related to this mystery of the deep state in empires now and then, who has the real power, the power over life and death, war and peace, in Rome at its peak?
What citizenship gave you was the right of protection against the arbitrary power of the state. So citizens could not be put to death without trial. They couldn't be subject to degrading or humiliating punishment. They couldn't be crucified, for example. And it's quite nice, in a sense, piquant story about St. Peter and St. Paul. St. Peter was crucified and St. Paul was executed. And that was because St. Peter was not a Roman citizen and St. Paul was. But what's crucial there is the citizen has, in a sense, a claim to personal liberty, to civil liberties against whatever the state might want to do with him. You cannot, or at least you should not, execute a Roman citizen without due process. And I think that that is absolutely fundamental to the whole way Rome thought about itself, about its citizenship rights, about what the state was, and about the limitations on the power of the state.
Mary Beard, I'm still puzzled about the fundamental power deal between patricians and plebes, or between vast wealth and slaves in the society, or between generals and their foot soldiers. But I'm also wondering about, was there any notion of what Burke later would call imperial justice, what Rome owed to the people it was conquering, or was it simply citizenship? Was that the prize?
These are really big questions. And I think that Rome was, in our terms, a society of vast disparities of wealth and pretty well formalized social hierarchies. It's very, very hard to imagine, I think for anybody now, what it would be like living pretty much on the breadline, on the top floor of a Roman tenement block, perhaps five to a room, when 100 metres away, 100 yards away, was, you know, a vast luxurious villa of a very rich senator. I've always thought perhaps that nothing could have been more humiliating and more irritating for the very poor to have to walk past, you know, the vast palace of the very rich only 100 metres up the road when they were starving.
In the seat of our empire, we're getting used to these mile-high monuments to money. I mean, $100 million per one-floor apartment overlooking Central Park in New York, for example. In the Rome version, I mean, did people consider this a corruption of the Roman dream or proof of its success?
I think they would have considered it proof of success. If you think about the Roman elite, there is a kind of a connection between their political power, their economic clout, and their display of their wealth. So that the powerful Roman citizen, in a sense, self-identified with his vast dwelling. I think it's very funny that when, or perhaps all too predictable, that when Roman politicians fall from favour, one of the things that often happens is that their houses get pulled down. It's important to see that this is shaded in all kinds of ways. Romans didn't blindly accept that. And the idea that the social hierarchy was on display, they did also wonder, and this particularly in relation to their imperial conquests, about what responsibility the elite had for the non-elite. For example, the conquered people of the empire. So they spend a very large amount of time wondering how to frame legislation which gave the provincial populations the right to prosecute Roman officials. Now, they might not always have been very successful, but in a way it is the other side of the power and the economic clout of the Roman elite that they did stop to think sometimes about what Roman power looked like from the other side and how to define what was corruption, how to define what was excess, and how to give the provincial populations a right to seek reparation for that corruption.
That's a start with Britain's favourite historian, Mary Beard, on the passion of her lifetime, SPQR, the Senate and People of Rome. Coming up, links and lessons for our guests and listeners to chew on in 2016, including the continuous theater of sensational violence in the Roman story, start to finish. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Mary Beard's Rome is our meet this hour around SPQR, her crowning history and unlikely bestseller about the Republic and Empire, Cicero and the Caesars, Nero and Caligula, splendor, corruption, all of it the touchstone of civic and civilizational arguments for 2,000 years, and 2016 in particular. Our guest Chris Hedges, when he covered his fill of war for the New York Times, took a year of his middle age at Harvard to study the classics, which led to his own classic hardcover, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Welcome. Welcome back, Chris Hedges. What drew you to Rome in the first place, and what did you bring back out of that history?
What drew me to Rome is the same thing that I think draws anyone to any past culture, and that is an attempt to become conversant in another era and use that literacy to look back, to free myself from the cant of modernity and look back at ourselves through the lens, through the perspective of another time. And that's why I think studying the classics is so important. T.S. Eliot's great essay, 1944, or lecture to the Virgil Society, talking about how, you know, that inability to be conversant with the past makes us unable to read the present.
But with it, you see what? What leaps out in this story for you?
In Mary Beard's book.
Yeah, and that history.
Well, that, you know, as the Greeks understood human life and human societies are cyclical, They're not linear. That's a biblical notion, but it's not something that's shared by most of the world, certainly not shared in the East, that it has periods of growth, maturation, decay, and death, that neither an individual or a society is immune from that. And great anthropologists like Joseph Tainer and others and the collapse of complex societies have looked at that cycle and found common patterns. History doesn't repeat itself, but it echoes itself. Roman society was different, and Kathy Coleman can elaborate on this better than I can. And yet, there are certainly important lessons to learn. The expansion of an empire beyond its ability to sustain itself, the capturing of total economic and political power by an oligarchic elite that drives the rest of the population into deeper and deeper forms of desperation, the assault on culture, so that by the time the Roman Empire, at least the half of the Roman Empire, disintegrates, you have a loss of not only the great sort of Roman poets, Catullus and others, but the Greek literature itself, which is not revived, and I mean, it's kept alive in a few monasteries. Although, like, you know, we lost, I think Aeschylus wrote about 60 plays. We have just a handful of them left. So there are certain templates that play out when empires go down, whether that's the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Roman Empire, or the American Empire.
The big theme being what? Overreach?
Well, the big theme being essentially the capture of power by a cabal which serves its own interests at the expense of the well-being not only of the citizenry, but of the state itself. So you have with the rise of figures like Sulla and Julius Caesar, maybe our first, I think Mary Beard calls them our first modern dictators, if I remember that right from her book, and then the civil wars that rent Roman society apart, the rise of Augustus, who keeps the trappings of power, keeps the Senate refuses to call himself an emperor, calls himself the first citizen.
Yeah.
But at that point, it becomes a facade. And I think we could argue that in many ways, electoral politics in the United States are a facade. There is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs, just as there was no way to oppose or vote against the interests of the ruling families, the corruption. I mean, Gibbon would argue descending morally into more and more depravity, especially sexual depravity, torture, this kind of stuff.
So Chris, we're going to get to every bit of that in the modern age, but stand by. In Mary Beard's Rome, there's a trail of blood that's inescapable in the founding myth and the day-to-day, in the Colosseum, in the foreign wars, in domestic relations, and in assassination as a hinge of politics. Here is Mary Beard again, historian of SPQR.
It's very, very hard to explain the violence at the root of Roman culture. And I think that comes out when you think of 50,000 people sitting in the Colosseum watching gladiators kill each other. They probably didn't kill each other as often as the movies suggest, but it certainly was a bloody and murderous kind of entertainment. The easy way out is to say, look, every ancient culture in the West was founded on violence, that the only sanction ultimately. However, there was an attempt to frame a rule of law which would contain violence. Ultimately, it was a world in which the ultimate arbiter was force. And this was not a world in which there was the United Nations or diplomacy. The ultimate arbiter was force. And my wonderful old professor in Cambridge, Moses Finley, always used to say, look, what you have to understand about the ancient world is it isn't that war breaks out, it's that peace breaks out. The standard position, the default position in the ancient world is war. That is how you relate to other people in violent conflict. Just occasionally, peace appears. But that's rare. And how you explain that, and I think it's something of a universal in the ancient world, it's very, very hard to know, except to say, gosh, they're a lot more violent than we are. I think what's puzzling and where you need to go a bit beyond that, though, is that the Romans themselves were very conscious of the violence on which their community was built, and they thought it was a problem. You find that very clearly coming out in the story of Romulus and Remus. As a foundation legend, it's a very odd one, because not only is it a city being founded by a pair of twins, that's not unparalleled in founding myths, but it's rare. But what is very striking in Rome is that one twin kills the other. Romulus murders Remus. Now, we don't exactly know when this legend was devised or elaborated, but we do know that Roman writers and Roman thinkers look back to that myth and they said, look, we are a city that is destined to civil war. It's destined to fratricide. This is a city that is built on brother murdering brother. We can't escape the cycle of this. And every time you get a major political turnaround, a major political revolution in Rome, you find that it is a violent revolution. It's often a revolution, not just brother versus brother, but violence against women. The democratic or the quasi-democratic Republic of Rome that was founded after an early monarchy, Romulus and the Seven Kings of Rome, that was founded after the rape of a woman. The rape of Lucretia is what prompted the kingship to be overthrown and a sort of democracy to be established. One of the things that struck me was how very often it wasn't just violent conflict that determined changing patterns of Roman politics, but it was also, it was rape. And that's something which the Romans' enemies and adversaries in the Mediterranean noticed. They said, look, what's Rome like? You know, Rome's a kind of place that when they want something, they just go and grab it, whether that's women or land or whatever. One of the very wrong ways of seeing Rome is to imagine that it was hugely militaristic and, you know, all around it were people being nice and minding their own business and, you know, sowing their crops and knitting and things like this. And the nasty Romans came along and, you know, with their swords and marched across their territory. Everybody was marching across everybody else's territory. But even so, Rome was constantly and consciously scrutinising the violence that in other ways it celebrated.
Our studio guest, Kathleen Coleman, was Chris Hedges' teacher at Harvard, born in Zimbabwe. She's a close reader of Roman pop culture on papyrus and in the famous live entertainment of the arena. I'm thinking gladiators fit that live spectacle of death into your picture of the empire.
Thank you, Chris. Well, everybody thinks of the Colosseum. In fact, all around the empire, in quite small communities, there were spaces where local magnates could make a big impression by putting on what to the capital must have been very, very small scale entertainments. And I think in order to try and understand how it was that wealthy citizens could build up their reputation by doing things like that, one has to understand that there's a kind of apartheid mentality that applies whereby you can do things to people of the servile class that you cannot do to free persons. And gladiators either were slaves or, if they were free, they assimilated themselves to the status of slaves by taking an oath that made them the equivalent of slaves in order to fight in the arena. And as Mary said, it is not necessarily the case at all that somebody died every time there was a gladiatorial display. These were very expensive people, gladiators. They were highly trained. This wasn't just a bloodbath of sending people in with absolutely no training. They were highly trained. They had to have a very good diet in order to be able to be, you know, beefy enough to do what they were supposed to do. They had to be housed. Slaves are expensive, actually. And the slaves in the arena were experts at what they were doing, and therefore they were a capital investment for the people who owned the troops or who hired the troops to put on these displays. And it's very difficult to estimate exactly what percentage of fights would have ended in a death, but many people think it wasn't more than probably about 5%.
Chris Hedges, you're the American writer who saw pro wrestling as the symptom of our American condition before Donald Trump discovered WrestleMania. You make the culture of Rome, that side of it, problematic from the beginning. Make the connections.
Well, any totalitarian society, as Hannah Arendt points out, is an image-based society and a spectacle-based society. And certainly, we can say after the death of the Republic, and this is Ronald Syme's great book, The Roman Revolution, which I think Kathy gave me to read, he understands that the rise of image and the rise of spectacle buttressed power. It diverted, and this is something Cicero railed against, it diverted the emotional and intellectual energy of the Republic into the spectacle, into the arena. And I think that's very much a part of the late stages of the American Empire. As I was listening to Kathy talk about gladiators, she could have been talking about NFL football players, you know, figures who we now know suffer disproportionate brain damage and, of course, heavily injured. So we see that as a society's becomes less and less functional politically, as people are removed from the actual process of controlling their own destiny, they are diverted in the same way that the citizens of ancient Rome after the death of the Republic were diverted. That's you know, I was writing my book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt with Joe Sacco, and we were down in southern West Virginia writing about the old coal camps. And one of the things we came across was that the coal owners subsidized the baseball teams in the individual coal camps to help break up the solidarity, and it worked, to break up the solidarity of, you know, union organizers by having people identify with, as the way people would identify with the gladiators. And I went to Pompeii with Kathy, and I remember, you know, she went around and was showing us all the places where people had written graffiti, you know, to their favorite gladiator, the same way people follow Michael Jordan. So I think this is often what happens, that there is a diversion of that energy, a diversion of that focus, you know, the famous kind of bread and circus. And American society is entranced by spectacle. You know, we...
Chris, I want to throw it back to Kathy. On Mary Beard says the Colosseum is the metaphor of the whole story. Ex-slaves, migrants in battle there for the masses. What was that picture affirming about the rest of Rome, including the foreign adventures, the military conquest that never stopped?
Well, one thing the Romans themselves recognized about the arena is that it was a microcosm of their own society. And there were spaces for every category of person to be present. Nicely, hierarchically organized, of course, not all mingling together. And the people with the most influence had the best view. That sounds familiar, I'm sure. But it wasn't, and it was an us and them event, because the people in the arena were objectified in a way that the people watching could feel sort of safe from and proud of, that they had the safety of that podium wall separating them from the spectacle that was taking place. But I think one should also recognize that the arena, in a way, is a sort of microcosm of empire, because it's not simply gladiators. That's what we focus on. But another very prominent element in the displays in the arena, of course, were these beast displays.
Stand by and hold that thought. Mary Beard in SPQR passes pretty quickly over the watershed in high school history of Rome, the moment in 49 BC when the warrior who had conquered Gaul, Julius Caesar, brought his army back to the homeland in defiance of the Roman Senate. The lesson was strongman unleashed, Republican danger maybe in tatters. I asked Mary Beard how Romans felt that difference.
Well, I think you'd know in various ways. I mean, one very obvious way is that I'm afraid democratic elections cease. The emperor himself appoints the officials of state. There are very occasionally a sort of a masquerade of elections. But the role of the people as electing the major officials of the state has gone. One dreads to say this. There were kind of compensations. I mean, I think it's the guys in the under the empire who looked back to the liberties of the Republic. They had a point. The really key decisions of state are taken in the back room of the palace. That's all true. It's not clear that in the last 100 years of the Republic, that democracy in our terms, if it ever had in Rome, had really functioned. The electoral system was important in some ways, but the state was by 80 BC, you know, 50 years before Augustus, the state was being run by a series of competing dynasts. They were fighting it out for the rule of the Roman world. Mm. And I'm sounding, and I don't mean to sound like this at all, I'm sounding like a terrible apologist for one-man rule, but it did actually stop what was the appalling internecine civil strife that actually was tearing Rome apart. So I think if you say, what would you notice? Well, you'd notice that actually there wasn't blood on the streets anymore.
Coming up, the Roman gift for merciless self-criticism, even under one-man rule. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. With Mary Beard and her SPQR, Ancient Rome in 600 Incisive Pages, we came back to the riddle of democracy and the deep state at the heart of a universal empire, in Rome's case, that never stopped calling itself a republic.
But I think what's very, very puzzling about the end of the republic and very puzzling about, therefore, about how to explain really what's going on between republic and empire is that actually the Senate isn't really the government. That becomes very clear at the very end of the Republic when the Senate tries telling both Caesar and his rival Pompey to put their armies down and stop it, don't fight, no civil war, you know, shut up, come back to Rome, you know, we're going to sort this out. And both of them totally ignore it and put two fingers up. It's a wonderful example of the way that, you know, the Senate actually, when you push, doesn't actually have any real power. It can't make law. It can't actually, in the end, tell people what to do if they aren't prepared to do it. The democratic assemblies prove to be equally powerless. Hmm. The historians, particularly the historian Tacitus, trying to compare, in a sense, the fighting, the jostling, the rhetoric, the conflict of the Republic with what was going on in the empire, saw, of course, that politics under one-man rule, within a court, within a single family, brought about the corruption of everything, you know, from sex to language.
I'm glad you mentioned Tacitus, because I'm interested in the consciences of Rome and the anti-imperialists as voices in the story. Tacitus is famous for deploring the legions abroad. At one point, he says, they create desolation and they call it peace. That line was revived during the war in Vietnam. It comes back and back in our adventures in Iraq and elsewhere.
Yes.
But there were others. I mean, Juvenal, the satirist, poets, historians. My guy, if I had a favorite emperor, it's Hadrian, who, 1,900 years before George W. Bush went into Iraq, he had pulled Trajan's investment out of the fire in Mesopotamia precisely. He said, no, we're pulling back. We're way overextended. We're coming home and we're going to reform the institutions right in Rome. Speak about the contrary impulses inside this republic and empire.
That's what I think is so wonderful about Rome. You know, you can tell a story about Rome that makes it sound, you know, brutal, unthinking, militaristic, and thuggish. And, you know, in some ways there are sides of Rome that were that. You know, if you were a Gaul and you were facing the armies of Julius Caesar, you'd think that Rome was brutal, militaristic, thuggish, and genocidal. But what makes Rome interesting, really interesting, is that within that, it was constantly constructing an alternative version, a critical version. It was constantly scrutinising itself and the consequences of its own empire. And I think one of my favourite stories is about the great, or the vicious, however you like to term him, destroyer of Carthage, Scipio Aemilianus, who finally razed Carthage to the ground, once the city of Hannibal, in 146 BC, when Rome is still only partly getting its empire. It's not really got anything like the full extent of its empire. Scipio goes to Carthage. It's a terrible siege, absolutely appallingly violent, and he orders the city to be burnt. And he's there, and at his side is the Greek historian who had been a hostage in Rome, a rather smart bloke called Polybius. Polybius spots that Scipio's crying, and slightly kind of dumbly, I think, on Polybius's part, he says, "Why are you crying, Scipio?" And Scipio basically says, quoting a line of Homer, "It's because the same thing's going to happen to Rome one day." There's a very strong sense that imperial power is a fragile enterprise. There's a very strong sense that imperial power upsets the very nature of the world. But I think what's interesting about Tacitus is not only does he give the world what is pretty much my favourite line of Latin literature, you know, they create a desert and call it peace. That description of military conquest has very rarely been bettered. But Tacitus also sees, I think, the way that, because he's so preoccupied with corruption, he sees that empire corrupts virtue, and that what gave Rome its empire was, his terms, very kind of macho manliness and virtus and virtue. And yet empire then attacks the very qualities that made it. And I think what's interesting about Tacitus's description, both of Germany and of Britain, is that he's come to see that by the beginning of the 2nd century AD, that where is virtue in the empire? He asks, where do you find virtus now? Well, you don't find it in the centre. Centre has been corrupted, whether that's by one-man rule, political violence or whatever. Where's virtue? It's on the margins. The people that we Romans think we can call barbarians are the very people that show us the virtue that we once had and no longer do.
This sounds like Noam Chomsky in America since Vietnam, or it sounds like Edmund Burke on the East India Company in India.
Yeah.
That it was a disgrace to English values, what they had done to human beings.
That's right. And of course, you know, the further irony about that is the very Brits who were looking at the consequences of British rule in India had partly learned what they thought about that from Tacitus.
That was Mary Beard of SPQR in conversation with us this week. In the studio, our guest, Kathleen Coleman. Chris Hedges on the line, teacher and student on this whole subject. Chris, where is our Tacitus? The answer, of course, is you're our Tacitus, scrutinizing us and the reality of our own fragile enterprise called empire. Let it rip. I mean, give us...
Well, anyone now within the American, let's call it mainstream, who attempts to offer a critique of empire, think of Chomsky, has essentially been pushed so far to the margins that they're not heard. We saw in the 60s on public television, which was why we used to have public broadcasting, so that voices not beholden to the elites could have space.
He was on our program in this.
Even Malcolm X.
But these are not unheard voices, Chris, and I'm struck that, you know, this week, young Americans under you know, under 45, 2-1 against the heavyweight favorite, Hillary Clinton, in favor of Bernie Sanders. Donald Trump creating all sorts of havoc on the other side. Something's cracking in this culture, let's make the most of it. Go for it.
Political superstructure, because you had the rise, in particular under the Clintons, of this faux liberalism, where you had people who, and we can go right back to the Republic of Rome, they continue to speak in that traditional language of democracy and that kind of feel-your-pain language of liberalism while assiduously serving corporate power, and Obama is as guilty of that as was Bill Clinton. There's complete continuity in terms of empire. Obama's assault on civil liberties has been worse than that actually carried out by his predecessor, George Bush. And so what's happened is that, as I mentioned before, you have power seized by this cabal that serves its own interests, and what it does is it creates political paralysis. So the government, in essence, is unable to respond to the needs, rights, and grievances of the citizens, and that gives rise to frightening movements. In the case of those who are flocking to Trump, nativists, militia types, Christian right, on and on and on, it is this proto-fascism where this legitimate rage is manipulated and directed at the vulnerable, at undocumented workers, Muslims, intellectuals, liberals, homosexuals, feminists. It's a long list. And that's what we're watching. The problem with Bernie Sanders is that he is not, unlike his predecessors, if he considers himself a socialist, Henry Wallace, Eugene P. Debs, taken on the military industrial complex, the war machine, which, as in Rome, is hollowing us out from the inside. Remember, the end of Roman, the Roman civilization was accompanied by a very physical decay. They weren't building colosseums. There wasn't the grand architecture. The aqueducts were falling apart in the same way, and also a flight from the cities. Rome itself was declining in population, and we see that in cities after cities across the United States.
Chris Hedges, we're looking at Rome. A Roman looking at us would see plebes on the march, whether it's students, you know, Black Lives Matter, immigrants. The president's proconsul in the great city of Chicago, Mayor Emanuel, in deepest trouble for the behavior of his own police force. President Obama, in his State of the Union, sounding what sounded like the end of deportation nation, putting immigration reform at the top of his list. I mean, something's afoot here. What would the Roman make of it?
Well, I thought Obama's address was fascinating, and that the undercurrent was a recognition of that fear, of that the rise of bigotry and hate talk and racism and hate crimes, all of which are attendant within a society in precipitous decline. And you are watching movements, grassroots movements, Black Lives Matter, as you mentioned, the anti-fracking movement, the BDS movement, they're all there. But at the same time, we are watching the rise of a very frightening counter-movement, which celebrates the gun culture, speaks in the language of violence. And America, like Rome, violence is part of our DNA. We were founded on the evils of genocide of indigenous peoples and slavery. And that is kind of our original sin, and it's still with us.
Chris, I want the teacher's view. Kathleen Coleman, what would a Roman see in this world?
I think what would really strike the Romans is that we do not appear to depend upon individual patronage for getting ahead. On an individual basis, people in society, they take exams and they apply for jobs, and there are all these rules about, certain questions you aren't allowed to ask in interviews and so on, and everything appears to proceed in a very democratic and independent manner. And that to a Roman would be enormously striking, I think, because Roman literature is full of anxieties about getting the right sort of patronage in order to get ahead. In fact, one of the most remarkable things I think about Roman culture is the fact it's a slave culture which freely manumits slaves. That is to say, give slaves their freedom. And this giving of slaves their freedom, from one cynical perspective, obviously if a slave is very old, well, let's give him his freedom and then he can die on the street and he's not our responsibility. But in fact, what they were very often doing was freeing slaves who are fully viable. They get a nest egg from their former owner and they become a kind of agent of that household. And they maintain very close ties with the household. They run businesses. And those patronage relationships are really fascinating. And we don't have anything quite like that in our culture. Of course, when you think about what's funding our elections, then you can see that there's a different kind of a patronage system that is operating in our culture, which probably wouldn't be recognizable to the Romans. But in individual terms, we have a kind of a freedom that I think they would have found very remarkable. But there is one thing I want to say, which hasn't come up yet, and I'm sure it's something that Mary's got interesting views on, but that is that there's really fascinating research at the moment which is correlating major political, I wouldn't say collapse, but major political fracture in the ancient world with major climate change.
Mm.
And this is going to be the most important thing, most important lesson we can learn from antiquity, I think, because we're facing it ourselves, but we've got our blinkers on. And the research that's being done with these ice cores and tree rings and things like that, able to correlate major, major shifts in population and migrations and so on, correlates exactly with moments of severe drought or severe flooding or severe weather conditions. And that's a lesson that we really need to take to heart, I think.
So that's fascinating. But speak to the end games, theirs and ours, Kathleen Coleman, and maybe Chris Hedges too before we're done. But how does it end? And what are the real portents? You say climate change. But it's broader than that.
Yeah, well, there's climate change and there are also these major pandemics that created havoc in the ancient world. We're still trying to understand the massive plague in the Antonine Age. And at the same time, there were still people struggling to do the right thing. And I want to just bat very briefly for the younger Pliny, who was a governor of the area of northern Turkey. And we have his correspondence with the emperor at Rome. He had to write to the emperor because the emperor was his boss. And when there was no template in the governor's archive for a particular problem, he had to write to Trajan and get Trajan's say so. And there he is trying to understand the natives of his area. And they behaved very oddly. And they had stinking sewers running down their main streets and all that kind of thing. And there is Pliny responsible for them. And recognizing that he has an imperial responsibility. So that amid all of the cynicism and the despair and the horror that you feel when you read Pliny's friend Tacitus, and they were friends, you still have this sense that the empire, when you're in it, is still functioning. It is functioning. And that is what is so fascinating about us having the long view, because we can see the thing crumbling when they couldn't see it themselves.
So what's to learn in the end from decline and fall?
We're going to fall. And we'd better enjoy our decline.
Is Chris Hedges still with us?
I am. I mean, I would, of course, second everything Kathy said, and we're going down. And, my fear is how we're going to go down. And the damage we'll do to others. Yes, climate change, Jared Diamond and Tainter and others have captured that. There's that great book, Easter Island, Easter Earth. The difference is this time it's planet-wide. It's global. There will be no new civilizations to conquer, no new people to subjugate and dominate, no new natural resources to exploit. And what's frightening about replicating the patterns of decline in the past is that this time there's no exit.
I just want to know, Chris Hedges, are we going to get to talk about it in this campaign of 2016?
I don't see anyone talking about it in a kind of very serious way. I mean, there is a kind of acknowledgement that climate change is real. But I'm sure you read the climate change reports as I do. Each one is more dire than the last. I think a lot of climate scientists are now saying we're beyond the tipping point. And we have not acknowledged the looming catastrophe before us. Even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, we would still see rising temperatures, rising sea levels, melting glaciers for decades to come. So the damage is there. And I think that, like, you know, declining societies, we are diverted away from reality towards to fantasy, towards entertainment, towards spectacle, towards illusion.
Chris, I always take you seriously, but I don't believe that in this smart and scientific, yes, distracted, maybe deluded country that we won't make some sense of this. Thank you, Chris Hedges. Thank you, Kathleen Coleman. Thanks to Mary Beard and to Louisa Field for recording her in Cambridge, England. You can read more on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by the Praetorian Guard of Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomino, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our first consul. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.